Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Peter Anderson, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both open-minded and open-hearted congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities, and later in the service we'll invite visitors, guests, and many of the FODs, friends of Dennis's, to introduce yourselves so we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community, or imminently our minister-to-be. Today, we're presenting a talk by Dennis Merritt on the Dairy Farmer's Guide to the Universe, and I think on behalf of the congregation, Dennis, I want to thank that Jungian magic for breaking the weather on us. Please welcome Kathy and Randy Converse to do the chalice lighting this morning and the opening words.
Excuse me. Ever bigger machines entailing ever bigger concentrations of economic power and exerting ever greater violence against the environment do not represent progress. They are a denial of wisdom. Wisdom demands a new orientation of science and technology toward the organic, the gentle, the nonviolent, the elegant, and the beautiful. E.F. Schumacher.
Dennis Merritt is his own joy and concern. The joy of someone having someone as illustrious and much to say as Dennis. The concern is something, as reading his bio, is a presider's tongue twister's nightmare. Dennis grew up in a small dairy farm south of Door County. He got his PhD from Berkeley in insect pathology, which is the use of naturally occurring insect pathogens to control insects. He is also a graduate of the Jung Institute of Zurich, Switzerland, and is in private practice as a Jungian psychoanalyst at the Integral Psychology Center on Monroe Street, shortly to be published as Volume 2 of The Dairy Farmer's Guide to the Universe, Jung, Herms, and Eco-Psychology. Please welcome Dennis Merritt.
Well, thank you for inviting me to speak here today. I'm actually a member of First Unitarian in Milwaukee, and in my 25 years when we lived in Madison, I was a member of First Unitarian here in Madison. And it was interesting, when I got to Milwaukee, Reverend Kennedy asked me if I ever had the introductory course that they teach there on Unitarian Universalism, and I hadn't, and I was really glad that I did, because I must confess, after 25 years going to First Unitarian here in Madison, I couldn't quite figure out what the Unitarians were about. So it's kind of like everything is flipped upside down, but I finally got the hang of it, and I quite appreciate it. One thing I will say, being from Kewaunee County, that's the county just below Door County, most people don't seem to know where it is, I realized that I really was a Unitarian at heart, because when you light this chalice, that is symbolic of Jan Hus's being burned at the stake in 1417. That's 100 years before Martin Luther pinned his 95 treatises on the door. So he was the first Czech to take the Wycliffe's Reformation into the church and practice it. This is in honor of Hus, and my mother's side is Czech, and Kewaunee County has more Czechs percentage-wise than any county in the country. Not more people, because we have more cows than people, but a lot of people of Czech descent. This is the first time that I've delivered a Sunday morning, I don't know what you call it, sermon or whatever, in a Unitarian society. In 15 years, the first time I did it was on the symbolic and psychological and spiritual dimensions of the weather and seasons here in the upper Midwest, and I called a sermon The Seasons of the Soul. There's an old Chinese saying, may you live in interesting times. And I always thought, to about a year ago, that that was a positive statement. And then I heard that it's really a curse. So we certainly are living in interesting times. I think that we are at a unique moment in the 4 million-plus year history of this planet. It's certainly a unique moment for our species and for many other species on the planet. If you look at where we are with regard to peak oil, we're probably past peak oil. So we have to go to the extremes and we get results like BP in the Gulf of Mexico. And those Canadian tar sands that we're getting the oil from, that's estimated to be ruining an area the size of the state of Florida. Then we have fracking going on in more parts of the country. And they're using unknown compounds, many of them suspected of being carcinogens, and it's unregulated thanks to Cheney's pressure on the environmental organizations. Our human population has probably exceeded the carrying capacity of our biosphere. And in the financial world, we had a collapse of the financial industry that just about brought down the economic systems for the whole world. And thanks to lobbying, no significant changes have been made in the financial industry. And to deal with all this, we have a very polarized society, Thunderdome politics, as it's called. And we have the perfect example here in Wisconsin. Need I mention our governor's name? The biggest element, of course, is climate change. Many experts say that we have but 10 years to turn things around, after which we will probably exceed a turning point and all bets are off after that. 30 years ago, the environmental modeling with these huge computers predicted that climate change would occur and what would happen would be freak and unique situations. So like extreme temperatures, extreme droughts, extreme amounts of rainfall, and extremely high winds. We're just beginning to see that. We've sown the seeds for this. This is just the shot across the bow, if you will. And it is estimated that because of our species, we're going to take down 30 to 50% of the species on this planet. And what's most disgusting is that the Royal Society of Science in England sent two letters to ExxonMobil reprimanding them for supporting an organization that is deliberately trying to confuse people about climate change, to make them think that there are scientists that doubt whether climate change is real. This is the same organization that Philip Morris had hired back in 91 or 92 to convince people or make people doubt that secondhand smoking caused cancer. So like I said, the Royal Society sent two letters to them. So where are we now? I think we are similar to a situation described in Hunger Games. I have a blog on that, Hunger Games from a Jungian political and environmental perspective, and I can tell you the blog site after a while. So what we need, I think, is some bold new thinking. It's an exciting time. We need some radical new approaches. We are going to take down 30 to 50% of the species. This is just the beginning of climate change. We are proverbially just rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. So let's build a new ship to sail on. That's what I say. And that's what I'm going to try to talk about today. So as the introduction said, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin, and that's where I established my connection to the land. I got out to Berkeley in the fall of 1967 to work on my doctorate in insect pathology. And as a result of being in Berkeley in the late 60s, I eventually discovered Carl Jung. I was 1A for the draft three times during the Vietnam War era. The third time was the end of 1968. That was the year of the Tet Offensive. And that's when I realized that politics was not a game, that human lives and many other things were at stake. And that's when I began to get politically very involved. So I went to train at the Jung Institute in Zurich in a way of combining my ecological side with my Jungian side has been to write on what I call Jungian eco-psychology for these past, I won't tell you how many years. So I've produced these two volumes so far, The Dairy Farmer's Guide to the Universe, Jung, Hermes, and Eco-Psychology. And I was going to bring a copy of my book up here as a picture of the dairy farm that I grew up on the cover.
It's coming.
All right. So what is eco-psychology? Eco-psychology is a study of how our attitudes, values, and perceptions, oh, ask and you shall receive. Thank you very much. This is the farm. Every farmer has an aerial view of their farm. So this is mine. Thank God my parents sold it to a young family that wanted to continue the family farm. Our neighbors have 5,000 cows, and they were highlighted before the Super Bowl. They wanted a farmer from Wisconsin. But the people that bought this farm are into organic farming, and they're going to be producing organic milk pretty soon. So that's eco-psychology, and it has elements of deep ecology, which says that we can connect far more deeply with the land than we currently are doing. And if we're connected with the land, we're naturally going to want to protect it. It also says that we have to look much more deeply at the environmental problem, try to find some of the root elements. So here's where Jungian psychology comes in. I am a Jungian analyst, so what I will present today will be a Jungian perspective as I interpret it. There are many different ways you can look at these problems, but today, like I said, you will hear a Jungian perspective. And one of the things that I most like about Jung is his very interesting analysis of the dominant religion of a culture. If you want to see what is at the base of a culture and what then becomes the source of the values and the attitudes, you look at the dominant religion. So Jung was a son of a Swiss Reformed minister, and from a long line of ministers, his wife as well, and spent his entire life thinking about Christianity and what it needed. And he focused on the story of Job. Job was written about 200 BC. Very interesting story, just to refresh your memory. Here is Lucifer, the light giver, up there in heaven, and he tells Yahweh, that servant of yours, Job, is really so devoted to you because he's got a nice wife, he's got all these kids, got all these big herds, all these abundant fields. That's why he likes you. And so Yahweh allows Lucifer to do whatever he wanted to with Job, short of killing him. Well, that's indeed what happened. And Job was ticked. So he demands an audience with Yahweh, and he gets it. And he's basically looking for an advocate of God against God. And Yahweh has no answer to Job. I mean, if Yahweh is omniscient and knows everything, he should have known that Job was a faithful servant. So Jung said that Job had seen the dark side of God. As a human being, we are the conscious part of creation, and God has another side to him, namely the devil. That is God's unconscious dark side. So God is always trying to blame humans for the problem, but it's really his unconscious dark side. That's how Jung framed it. So Jung said, Christianity is not a monotheism, it's a dualistic religion. On the earth, the devil is of equal power to God. So in our culture, we have a split God image, if you will. So, because Yahweh had done a moral injustice to Job as a representative of the human species, then Yahweh had to incarnate to atone for it. And Jung said, there's a Freudian slip. So, Jung said when Jesus was on the cross and felt abandoned by God, that's when God realized what Job felt like, and what human beings feel like. But Jung said this was insufficient, that Yahweh had tried to incarnate in a pure human being. What Jung's main message for modern men and women is that God wants to incarnate in a sinful human being. We, if you think of this world, this universe, as being the manifest side of God, if you will, then humans are the conscious part of this universe. So we're the conscious part of God, in a way. So what happened then, I don't know how many of you have read the book of Revelation, but it's an amazing piece of writing at the end of the New Testament. And it's like a psychotic nightmare. Here's Jesus dripping in blood after destroying anybody that has opposed him or said something against Christianity or something. And half of the planet is destroyed, sort of like Vietnam when the Westmoreland said we have to destroy it to save it. So the four horsemen of the apocalypse are riding, drought, disease, famine. The seven seals are open, all this wrath is poured out upon the earth and its creatures. I mean, what is this anyway? So Jung thought that the Christian era was the age of Pisces. Those wise men that came from the East, they were astrologers. They were following a star. So Christ was born at the beginning of the 2000 astrological age of Pisces. And Pisces is two fish swimming in opposite directions. So as Jung saw it, the first 1,000 years, humans were built up and the positive side of God was emphasized. The second 1,000 years, basically it's been downhill ever since. Jung died in 1961. So he saw the dark side of the Christian era as coming out as communism, Nazism, the destruction of the environment, and the atomic bomb. But there was a positive element in the book of Revelation. And this is perfectly presented, of all places, in University of Wisconsin Madison Memorial Library. As you go into the library, main entrance, on the left is a huge mosaic called a library, but it's a perfect depiction of this image. Somewhere between all this destruction, a woman from heaven, started to descend, very pregnant. And she had a sun on her chest, a crown of stars, standing on a crescent-shaped moon. Then she has a newborn male baby, and she's confronted by a seven-headed dragon. So Yahweh draws the infant back up into heaven, takes the woman off into the wilderness. And that's the end of that story. Jung said that was a very pagan insert into this Christian story. The sun, the moon, the stars, that was a very pagan element. And Jung said that that infant represented a new consciousness that Christianity was not ready for at that time. Jung thought that there had to be a paradigm shift in the West. And that's what I think we are facing now. The environment is forcing us to change our paradigm and in relationship to each other and in relationship to the environment. And it was Jung who coined the terms New Age and Age of Aquarius to describe that paradigm shift. And he said that that infant in that vision that you see at the Memorial Library is symbolic of the consciousness, this new consciousness that's going to be born at the beginning of the New Age, the Age of Aquarius. Many people think that began in 1968. And when was that song, that play Hair popular? All right, the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. Now what Jung also recognized was that the alchemists were some of the most intelligent men and women in Europe. Isaac Newton wrote more about alchemy than he did about physics. And they were working with chemicals and stuff before there was chemistry. So they were looking at all this stuff in their retorts and vessels and all the changing colors and everything. And they were having visions and dreams about it. So Jung said that the alchemists were projecting the post-Christian unconscious into their vessels and retorts. What Christianity had left out, namely the body, the feminine, sexuality, animals, and the earth, the alchemists were trying to re-ensoul and re-spirit. The alchemists felt that Jesus had saved the human psyche, and they were trying to bring the spirit back into the macrocosm, into the universe. So alchemy became Jung's main symbolic system for his psychoanalytic approach and for working with dreams. So, question is then, how do we bring about this new age? And that's what I'm going to focus on the rest of my time. I'll start with a quote from Jung. He said, "The human psyche must be studied. We are the origin of all coming evil." And this relates to a saying by Jesus. I see Jesus as being a very good psychoanalyst. And here's a typical psychoanalytic statement. He said, "Why are you so concerned about the sliver of wood in your brother's eye when you don't see that 2x4 of wood," I'm paraphrasing, "in your own eyes?" So in other words, it's a psychological premise. Our dark sides, our own shadow sides, people that we're envious of and so on, we can't see that in ourselves. We project it out into the environment, and then we are hostile to the people out there. It's really the source of racism, sexism, homophobia, etc. So if you think of the fact then that 31% of the believers across all denominations believe in a personal relationship with a judgmental God, you're talking about God on your side in a universe of good and evil. And I think it's this type of belief that feeds this impasse that we have in our society and in our political system. It's either my way or the highway. If you're convinced that you have the absolute truth, how can you run a democracy if somebody thinks differently than you do because God is on your side? Another issue is what I call faith-based reality. So 49% of the Republicans, 39% of the Democrats believe in six-day creation. This is in the 21st century. The Monkey Scopes trials were back in 1920. So if people have a sense of reality like this, and God's on their side, and a good and evil world, this is what we contend with. I always get very nervous when the Republicans have an open primary in Iowa. I thought, my God, I mean, this is the 21st century. So what did Jung say about this? And this is a challenge to academics and intellectuals. Jung said that until we can have a sense of the numinous in our educational system and accepted by the intellectuals, we're not going to have a holistic education. So the psychological rule of thumb is that what is denigrated and not honored turns against us. And I think that we have abandoned the field to these mega churches, if you will, and these preachers that have little sense of the Bible and basically are coming from their own family of origin ideas about what is right and wrong, and therefore gets turned into good and evil. Jesus said, "When you were children, you learned as children. As an adult, you should learn as an adult." He also thought that Jung thought that spirituality was the most important dimension of the human experience. So it depends then, we're obviously all capable of having spiritual experiences. It's not hardwired, it's something that has to be fostered. You have to have an environment, including an educational environment, that fosters the idea, supports the idea of spirituality. And it's related to Jung's archetype of the self, that every person has within them a centering and a centering element, produces your dreams, if you will. And it's what is of ultimate importance to you. At the cultural level, the self is Jesus, Buddha, Lakota Sioux call it Wakantaka, Allah, etc. Now, what's really important here is that the phenomenology of the self is that the people that have experienced it think that this is the ultimate truth. It's always been this way, and it always will be that way, and it's an overwhelming emotional experience. The problem is that there are many different takes on the self, depending on the person, the point in history, the culture, etc. So, if you understand the phenomenology is the same, then one way we can deal with these spiritual differences is to understand how I can say, I've got the best dog in the world, and you can say, I've got the best dog in the world, and we're both right. It's different takes, different strokes for different folks, as they sang about in the 60s. Another way of dealing with the issues here is to have an ecological concept of the human psyche. I think that's very important. And Jung's idea was of dreams. If you think of a dream that you're in and several other people, well, you and the dream is closest to your dream ego. But who are all those other people? Jung called it the little people within. And it's important for us to be able to relate to all those other elements that are and are not part of ourselves. Because how we relate to our inner figures, to our own unconscious, sets the tone is the same way that relate to people out here and to the environment. So environmental work ultimately has to start with an ecological sense of our own psyche. My image for that is the Chinese ideogram or picture word for the sage, which if you look at the elements for the picture word, it's the ear listening to the inner king. That's what the sage means to the Chinese. It's a receptive position, an ear listening to the inner king. There's obviously something in our psyches that is bigger than our ego constructs. And that, in the extreme, if you will, is the divine or God. So that inner king represents that. The other main thing that we have to look at are our systems. You can have good people doing bad things because of the systems they're caught into. And the readings that were given before play right into this. Jung said that the present day monsters are not dragons and witches. They are big machines and big organizations like big military and big business. The example he gave was, imagine what the little merchant felt like when he was gobbled up by the Standard Oil Trust. So that is our modern monster. To me, the Titanic primarily is corporate personhood. And until we can change corporate personhood and the recent Supreme Court decision, I think all the environmental activity and everything we have is not going to work because it's all rigged. And we have to somehow get united and change what corporate power is all about. Because with Citizens United, there's no way we can compete with the oil companies that are going to make a profit this year of $136 billion. Jung also emphasized the importance of consciousness, that we had to become as conscious as possible. That includes not only of our own unconscious, but also in this day and age of our niche in the environment. Like Aldo Leopold said, we have to realize as a human species where we fit in with the environment. And that means, I think, by definition, for humans to be part of the environment, we have to be symbolically, mythically, emotionally, and creatively related to nature. Jung's a challenge was to unite our cultured side with the 2-million-year-old man within. And Carl Sagan, before he died, said that unless we can establish a sense of the sacred about the environment, the ball game's over. So that means that we have to bring together religions and science to do this. So our species has to get its act together. We need new economic concepts. The latest theory is that the reason some nations fail and other nations succeed is primarily because of that nation's ability to prevent the accumulation of wealth. We're talking about the 1% here. That is the latest economic theory. The Israelis had the idea of a jubilee. Every 49 years, he would redistribute things. So if we are in a Christian society, how are we honoring Jesus saying, I was hungry, and did you feed me? I was without shelter. Did you give me a place to stay? And so on. Instead, Christianity seems to have devolved into issues about abortion and gay rights and that sort of stuff, where it's clear the message of Jesus was love and that statement about was I hungry and so on. The last element then is the feminine. Jung said that in this new age there would be a resurgence of archetypal feminine energy. Archetypal feminine energy is about process, it's about relationship, it's about community. Quite the contrast of power games epitomized by the Packers winning the Super Bowl. So, to summarize then, to prevent the Book of Revelations from becoming literally true, we have to realize that God wants to incarnate in a normal, sinful human being, and that we are co-creators with God. We must become as conscious as possible of our intrapsychic dynamics and understand the evolution of our symbolic systems and our religious systems. Have to honor the numinous in our educational systems, own our shadow, develop spiritually, develop ecological concepts of the human psyche, change our systems like corporate personhood, work on individuation, becoming all we can be, as the Army said, that's the contrast to consumerism, integrate our cultured side with the 2-million-year-old man within, and become truly Christian in loving others, feeding the hungry, etc., cultivating the archetypal feminine, and limit our population growth. So to me, the one charter that summarizes this is the Earth Charter. It was done by the United Nations. Please Google it if you're not familiar with it. It's about how to live sustainably and to develop social, political, and economic justice. That's about as much as I can say in 25 minutes. So I hope I've thrown out enough for some good discussion. I understand this is a group that likes to discuss things. Jung deals with it, and it's one of the problems I have with Jung. I think he was paranoid about communism, and that's what I write about in Volume 2. It just came out. In fact, it's not officially out, but I look at the lacuna. Jung said every psychology is a subjective confession, and I think that Jung had a severe attachment issue problem, and I think that's why he could not really relate to the essence of Christianity of God as love. He could not relate to Jesus. His God was this incredible, awesome, sort of like in Job, actually, energy that created the universe. And because of that, for example, in the Jung Institute in Zurich, when they tried the Institute group therapy in 1970, von Franz, the main Jungian, threatened to withdraw from the Institute because Jung didn't believe in group therapy. So, I think the beauty of Jung's system is this idea of archetypes, that every god represents them and goddess represents kind of archetypal energies. So you can find the lacuna in Jung's psyche and then find out what archetype he was missing, namely the archetype of the nurturing mother, and plug it right back into the system. And that's what we're up against. I mean, we're a society where 70% of the economics depend on consumerism. So if all we have every day, all the time, telling us how we can be happy if we buy this or that, I mean, what do we expect? And then we have corporations and corporations treated as people. This is the Titanic, as far as I can see. The blog is JungianEcopsychology.com. That's where I have some links to the tar sands thing and Citizens United and so on. I'm afraid that the seeds that we are sowing at an accelerating rate with regard to climate change is going to make it extremely difficult for our species to survive. You can imagine the amount of massive migrations of peoples we're going to have when Florida floods halfway, when downtown New York City is flooded, et cetera, et cetera. And the extremes now just riding out from Milwaukee today, all the fields are turning brown. I mean, this is what we're heading toward, and we're not doing anything about it, essentially nothing about it. That to me is another example of corporate power. One of the reasons I went to Berkeley is because they had the largest department of biological control in America. They had 100 100 graduate students. That department no longer exists. And one of the reasons is the head of that department thought he was, saw himself as being in a one-man war against Shell Chemical. And in the Central Valley in California, they grow a lot of cotton, and they can put whatever they want to on cotton. So Vandenbosch did a careful study of the cotton plant with regard to pesticides and realized that if you didn't spray for the Liguus bug, which doesn't like cotton, then you wouldn't kill all the natural enemies off of pests that then became pests because their natural enemies otherwise controlled them. And he had to fight to get a law through the California's legislature to say that the farm advisors were not representatives of the chemical companies. And it's that type of thing. And lo and behold, somehow or another, the entomology department disappeared in Berkeley in the mid-70s.
Wow.
The insects. Yeah. However, most of the species on the planet are insects. And every time we lose some more of the rainforest, that's where most of the insects are. I, as an entomologist, I'm up here speaking on behalf of the insects of the world. Every insect represents about 250 million years of evolution. The flowering plants evolved together with the insects to pollinate them. That's how old insects are. You got it.
In the early 1960s.
Yep. What happened was, up until World War II, there were all these many different studies of how to manage insect populations. With the advent of DDT and then modified German nerve gases called organophosphates, entomology got reduced to spray and count. And what was frightening to me is when I went from entomology to being a Jungian analyst, is that's the same model we have in the medical world. The psychopharmacological model is that humans are just a big chemical factory. And if you got a psychological problem, it's because of some chemical imbalance, and we happen to have a rather expensive pill that'll take care of it. So given the pressures on healthcare, it's either you are disturbed enough to see a psychiatrist and get psychotropic meds, and because you're about to commit suicide, or you're not suicidal, so you don't need treatment. So I did happen to bring some copies of my book along. And I'll be at the little table in the hallway after a while. Good question. Jungian psychology, almost by definition, is always kind of on the fringe. We're in a very hermetic position because we're always on kind of the growing edge. A lot of artists and creative people and people interested in their dreams and so on. If there are many powerful Jungian ways of working, and if one can get the dream work going, it's probably the most efficient if you want to think of it in those terms. So a lot of people pay out of pocket, but there are definite ways, and I actually have an article on my website. I have a business card here talking about a short, brief Jungian psychotherapy. And there are things with the I Ching, for example, Chinese Book of Wisdom one can use, sand play therapy, etc. It doesn't fit into 5-session therapy. If you're with an HMO and you're a provider with an HMO in Madison, you have to average 5 sessions per person. Otherwise, you have problems with the powers that be.
Thank you so much, Dennis. We greatly appreciate you coming and sharing
your wisdom. Thank you. Thank you.
My closing words will be by Alan Middleton and James Lovelock.
Metaphor is important because to deal with, understand, and even ameliorate the fix we are now in over global change requires us to know the true nature of the earth and imagine it as the largest living thing in the solar system.
Thank you, Al. Thank you all for coming, including the Watertown contingent. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you, and then join us for coffee and conversation. Thank you very much.